Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining the Exploring Every Potential Research Solution. As a reminder, please be sure to log on to the proper web conference using the entry code 43584. The presentation will now begin.
Good evening, everyone. This is Susan Bradley. I'm president of the Southern California and Nevada chapter, and I'm delighted to welcome everyone from my own chapter as well as those who've just joined us from the Northern California chapter. Just 2 years ago, the National MS Society launched NOW, an MS Research Revolution. This was a bold initiative across that arose from the need to address the hopes, frustrations, and expectations of people across our movement. And we heard loud and clear from people like you that the Society needed to significantly increase our investment in research funding. And so we launched the first comprehensive campaign for all research to bring findings from bench to bedside. And we set an aggressive goal to raise $250 million in MS research funding by 2016 so that no stone would be left unturned and no opportunity wasted. And at last week's leadership conference for the MS Society, we learned that we're halfway there, an amazing accomplishment that will bring us closer to a cure for MS. And just as MS is a multifaceted disease, so must our approach to developing solutions. And our commitment is a comprehensive strategy that's focused on three different results: stop, restore, and end. Stopping MS in its tracks means we must find ways to stop all disease activity and prevent further progression for those who already have MS. And we can do this by advanced imaging and laboratory studies that seek to define and measure disease activity. And with research focused on understanding how the MS immune attacks are triggered and may provide new avenues for stopping those attacks. Second, we need to restore lost function. And by researching innovative rehabilitation techniques to improve walking, strength, and balance, and investigating those complementary and non-traditional therapies to combat specific symptoms. And third, we need to end this disease forever, and that means we're looking toward the future and are working to eliminate MS from our world and prevent it from ever occurring in the future. This includes examining specific MS genes to uncover paths through which they influence the disease process, and population studies examining a host of factors such as things like vitamin D impact, sun exposure, smoking, pediatric cases of MS, to uncover exposures that may trigger the disease or protect against it. So tonight I'm thrilled to have Dr. Liliana Amescua, Dr. Nancy Sicott, and Dr. Emmanuel Wilbont here to share their projects aimed at stopping MS, restoring function, and ending this disease. So please jot down any questions you have during their presentations, and once all three researchers have finished, we'll open the lines and give you the opportunity to ask questions to our speakers. So now let me introduce our first speaker, Dr. Liliana Amescua, who is Assistant Professor of Neurology at University of Southern California and co-director of the USC MS Comprehensive Care Center and Research Group. She serves on the Clinical Advisory Committee for the Southern California and Nevada Chapter and is a council member of the Society's Hispanic MS Advisory Board. Dr. Amescua? Dr. Amescua, are you ready to start your presentation? Do we have Dr. Amescua on the line? What I'm going to do right now, because we appear to have a little bit of a technical issue for Dr. Amescua, is I'm going to skip over. Dr. Sicott, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Could we forward the slides, and we'll loop back to Dr. Amescua when we are able to reconnect her. So if you could bear with me for a minute, I'd like to introduce Dr. Sicott. Dr. Nancy Sicott is director of the Multiple Sclerosis Program and director of the Neurology Residency Training Program at Cedars-Sinai. She's the principal investigator on numerous MS clinical trials and is the recipient of many honors and awards, including being named 3 times in the Best Doctors in America. Dr. Sicott is chair of the Clinical Advisory Committee for the Southern California and Nevada chapter and is often sought after for her expertise on MS. Dr. Sicott, go ahead and tell us about your research.
Great. Well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here this evening, and I love this techie project that we're doing here. As I was telling Audra, I've been tweeting, and now I'm doing a webcast, so I feel like I'm in the 21st century here. So I'm going to very briefly talk about the work I've been doing on hippocampal imaging. So this is a project that has been funded the whole way along by the National MS Society, and we are very grateful for the support of the Society as well as all of the people who have taken part in the studies and have also contributed their time and energy for fundraising. So one of the things that's happened in our understanding of multiple sclerosis, in part because we've been using MRI now for a long period of time to diagnose patients and also to monitor disease activity, monitor the effect of medications. We've also learned a lot about the disease just from using imaging approaches. And one of the things that's been very interesting and we sort of knew this already, but we had to rediscover it, is that the surface of the brain and the deep structures of the brain are affected in multiple sclerosis, which is classically known as white matter disease, or, you know, the myelin is what we always hear about as being affected in MS. But the neurons themselves, which form the gray matter, are also impacted by the disease. And this is an important potential target for protecting and reversing the nervous system, reversing damage to the nervous system. So what we know now from many different kinds of studies is that the gray matter, as I said, is impacted, and that includes the cortex, which is the surface of the brain, as well as these other structures that I was describing, including the basal ganglia, the thalamus, and the hippocampus. So the hippocampus, if for anyone who's involved in neuroscience research, eventually you end up studying this structure because it's so fascinating and so central to the function of the human brain. It's a very old part of the brain. If we could just go back one slide, please. Thank you. It's a very old part of the brain. It has 3 layers instead of the usual 6 layers that is on the in the regular what we call neocortex, the areas that make us different from lower animals. But the hippocampus is this old structure. It's tucked into the temporal lobes, and it's critical for memory and also for mood regulation. And you may be aware of this or heard of this in relation to Alzheimer's disease, because this is a structure that is affected with memory. But what's really interesting and what I think brings it into center focus is that it's really also very much impacted by high levels of stress hormones, and that includes cortisol. So next slide. A lot of people talk about stress and how stress can impact lots of different diseases, and I think the hippocampus may be part of the answer and maybe the structure that lies at the center of some of these effects. So this is just a cartoon showing a lateral view of the brain and showing you where the hippocampus lives. It's that green structure there tucked behind another very old structure called the amygdala. So next slide. The hippocampus derives its name from seahorse, and you see here a dissected hippocampus showing the very unusual structure and then the curving fornix, which is the white matter pathway. I thought that was a really cool picture, so I included that. If we look on an MRI, and this is a coronal view, so as though you're cutting the brain from the top straight down, in the red there you see that dark, on the other side you can see the matching hippocampus, but that's what the hippocampus is. It's very deeply embedded in the brain there. So next slide. We have used and looked at the hippocampus because we think that it may be one of the structures that may be the underlying substrate for cognitive impairment in MS. And this is because of some data, not from our lab, but other labs that have shown that there are lesions on pathological specimens within the hippocampus, and that this demyelination has been associated with a loss of synapses. Those are connections between neurons, as well as altered gene expression. And as we know, cognitive impairment is common in MS, and that the problems also include memory processes, and the hippocampus is really critical for forming new memories. Next slide. This is just a detailed image of the hippocampus. That's a pathological specimen that's on the left showing a myelin stain, and you can see how complex this small structure is, and it's kind of rolled up like a jelly roll. On the right-hand side is a cartoon showing the different subregions of the hippocampus, and these are very important because they're actually all mediating different functions. Next slide. So we used a high-resolution MR imaging technique, next slide, to be able to look at these different subregions within the hippocampus and see how they are impacted in MS. And that shows you, A, shows you the setup of the MRI scans, B, shows you the coronal view, and C, shows you the very high resolution we were able to obtain using a 3-Tesla scanner and a very high resolution protocol. And then we went through manually and looked at these different subregions, and I would just draw your attention to the yellow, which is called CA1, as well as the red area, which is CA23/DG or dentate gyrus. So those are the two areas we'll be talking about. Next slide. So what we found in our first study that was funded by the MS Society was that we were able to detect that there was volume loss in the hippocampus. So if you look at A, you can see that in both relapsing and secondary progressive MS, that the total volume of the hippocampus was lower, especially in the secondary progressive group. When we then looked at the subregions, it was very interesting because we saw that a lot of this effect seemed to be coming from one particular region called the CA1. And if you look at the graph there, you'll see that the relapsing patients, even though they were very early on in the disease, had some changes in CA1, a little bit more than what you saw in the other subregions, and that suggested that CA1 might be a target or particularly vulnerable in MS. Next slide. And we also looked at the relationship between the changes in those regions and particular functions. And this was actually important because, as we know, there are lots of cognitive things that are impacted in MS, including what we call information processing speed, or how quickly you can do things. And the PACEAT is a test that some of you may have done this, which is a quite painful test where you have to add up numbers. It's part of the MS functional composite. We did not find a relationship between performance on the PACEAT and these measures of the hippocampus, but we did find, as you'll see highlighted in the yellow, that measures of verbal memory, so your ability to learn new pairs of words, was related to the hippocampus in these subregions, in particular on the left side, which is a side that is more focused on language function. So it was very exciting that we had a very specific effect on cognition localized to the hippocampus. Next slide. So in this first study, we were able to show that there was hippocampal atrophy that was detectable early in MS and was more pronounced in CA1, and that it was associated with difficulties with learning new words, verbal memory, but not this information processing speed. We were intrigued by the fact that the CA1 volumes were impacted early. These were not correlated in the study with white matter lesion volumes or the use of steroids. Next slide. But it raised a lot of questions. What was causing this effect? And as we know, demyelination is associated with a loss of neurons. There are demyelinating lesions that are located in the cortex, on the surface of the brain. This is something that we've seen on pathology, and maybe that was causing it. But we were really interested in whether steroid effects, meaning steroids that you take, which we didn't seem to have an effect, or steroids from stress could be impacting the hippocampus, and in particular the CA1. So next slide. So one of the reasons this is important is that depression is related to high levels of cortisol as well as cognitive impairment. And it turns out that the hippocampal region that's most sensitive is CA1. And the hippocampal subregion, there are different subregions that are important for mediating control of this cortisol control system, which is the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, or HPA axis. We do think that the from other evidence that the hippocampal subregion that's most sensitive to cortisol, in animal models at least, is CA3 and the DG region, the dentate gyrus region. So next slide. So we did a second study to assess the role of stress hormones and to see which part of the hippocampus was impacted and if it was related to depression. So we did the same MRI imaging. We collected saliva, which it turns out is a very good measure. You can get a good measures of cortisol or stress hormones by measuring saliva, and we do it throughout the day. And then we looked at depression. Next slide. And what we found in this study is we took the whole group together. We were able to replicate the findings from the first study. And again, this is another study that the MS Society supported. And so if you look at A on the graph there, you can see that looking at the hippocampal subregions, that we were able to see a change in CA1, just as we had seen before, between healthy controls and MS patients. And we also found another area that was decreased called the subiculum, and that also reached significance in this group. And then we looked at the cortisol secretion pattern. So that's in C, and this may be a little complicated to explain over the phone. But normally, if you think about your cortisol secretion patterns, they're high in the morning. That's what wakes you up in the morning. And normally, they decrease over the course of the day, so that by the time the nighttime comes, around 9 o'clock, you're really pooped and you want to go to sleep. So in people who have MS, there's a little bit different pattern, which you can see that nighttime dose, the nighttime level, the 9 p.m., is actually higher in the MS patients, and there's a trend also for the 4 p.m. to be a little bit higher. So it looks like the MS patients don't drop their cortisol as quickly as healthy controls, and that was just sort of the overall group. But we saw something very interesting when we looked at depression and depressed and non-depressed patients, which is on the next slide. We can just skip that. We divided them by the presence of depressive symptoms, and let me just show you the slide here. So if you look at the blue on this slide, you can see that a lot of those differences are very dramatic in patients who have depressive symptoms. So these are people who scored high on a self-rating of depression. And what we see here is that a lot of these effects are exaggerated or exacerbated in the depressed patients. So we saw CA1 was decreased like we had seen overall, but we now saw a big effect in the other region called the CA23DG, that second region, and I'm looking up on the graph on A. And then if you look right below that at cortisol secretion, you can see that the depressed patients really have an altered cortisol secretion pattern. They're very flat, that if you look at the time course from 8 until 9 on, and then 8 till 9, you see how much flatter that slope is in the depressed patients. So they are really keeping high levels of stress hormone later in the day. And we think that this may be important in mediating hippocampal changes. So if you look, go ahead to the next slide. So this does raise the question of sort of chicken and egg in terms of what's causing what. So you have depression, and we know that depression is associated with smaller hippocampal volumes. And does that lead to a hyperactivity of the stress hormone pathways, or is it the stress hormone pathways are hyperactive and that causes a change in the hippocampus and that leads to depression? Of course, it could be a circle rather than a linear relationship, but it appears that these three factors are definitely related. Next slide. So we are looking now at whether there are differences within the hippocampus so that we can kind of separate out that memory and MS-related, direct MS-related damage is specific to CA1, but that we may have a second area, the CA3 and dentate areas, that are related to depressive symptoms and are associated with having high levels of cortisol. So we're looking at these two subregions for these two most common symptoms, sort of hidden symptoms in MS patients, cognitive impairment and depression. Next slide. So our next steps are we have an ongoing study, next slide, where we are tracking hippocampal, we're doing a bunch of different things, but this is a project that we're working on to look at overall changes in the hippocampus over time. And one of the things that this will allow us to do is to see if we can intervene in this process and actually slow down or even reverse these changes, the loss of tissue that occurs within the hippocampus. So this is a surface technique. So rather than seeing the sort of like the seahorse, but it's we don't see the whole tail of the seahorse, but this is a surface mapping approach where we can monitor changes over the whole hippocampus. And this is a pretty simple way to do it. We don't have to do manual segmentation. And this gives us a tool then to look at interventions, which is our ultimate goal. So next slide. But right now we have an ongoing project where we're looking at these very specific subregional effects associated with depression and cognitive impairment and cortisol. And what we're doing is seeing if the depression that people experience in MS and the changes within the hippocampus are the same as what we see in people who have depression but don't have MS. And this is to try and understand the underlying pathophysiology or underlying cause of depression in people who have MS. Because as many of you know, that's very, very common that MS patients suffer depression. And we are looking at understanding the biology of that and then using some of these high resolution and high tech approaches with the hippocampal mapping to look at interventions that could reverse that process and allow us to develop interventions that are going to improve depression. And so things that we are interested in looking at would be pharmacology. You know, there's certain pharmacological approaches that may be helpful, but also lots of behavioral things like exercise, stress reduction, meditation. As you know, there's a lot of studies now indicating that decreasing stress leads to better outcomes. So we are still recruiting for this ongoing study. We're looking at MS patients who have depression and MS patients who do not have depression. We're also scanning healthy controls, and we're scanning people with major depression but no history of MS. So the phone number is up there. My research assistant, Julie Pham, will be happy to screen anyone who might be interested in taking part. But we are more than halfway through this study, and we're really excited about it. And then last but not least, just want to acknowledge all the people who've been involved in ongoing projects as well as funding. As you can see, the MS Society has been very much front and center with funding this project. So I hope that wasn't too complicated and technical. Very happy to take questions when we get to the end, or anyone's happy, you know, feel free to email me or contact me through the MS Society. So thanks so much for the opportunity to talk about this work.
Well, thank you, Dr. Sicott. That was a really fantastic presentation, and I know I learned a lot about depression and some of the links to MS, and I just want to thank you for your time on the call today, and we look forward to our Q&A session at the end. Our next speaker, we're going to move on to hear from Dr. Emmanuel Wobont, who is currently Professor of Neurology and Pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco. She has directed the UCSF Medical Clinical Research and Fellowship Programs for many years and currently directs the Regional Pediatric MS Center at UCSF. Dr. Wobont serves or has served on the Clinical Care and Fellowship Program Committees of the National MS Society, on the Advisory Board of the Society's Northern California Chapter, and she is the Chair of the Scientific Program of the Americas Committee on Treatment and Research on MS and is chairing the Pediatric MS Network Steering Committee. And we're thrilled to have Dr. Wobont join us. So thank you so much, and we look forward to hearing your presentation.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to share with you some of the ongoing research. And I hope that you know, in addition to the technical issues we may have with the speaker phones and so on, my accent will not be a complication to understanding what I'm going to talk about. So some of you probably are wondering why I'm going to talk basically about bugs that are in your guts when we're talking about MS being a disease in your brain and in your spinal cord. And I'm going to try to explain to you why researchers over the past few years actually have come up with a lot of interest in studying bugs in the gut and probably also in other areas of the body as it could relate to multiple sclerosis. So the next slide, please. So this slide just tries to recapitulate what we understand about the causes of MS. And we think overall that there's a bunch of genetic factors and a bunch of environmental factors that contribute together actually at basically the perfect storm. In terms of genetics, you've heard from one of the previous speakers that there's many genes that are now involved in disease susceptibility. And with the recent report this year of 40 additional genes, there's more than 110 genes that participate to increase the susceptibility to MS. In terms of environmental factors, factors like exposure to cigarette smoking, Epstein-Barr virus infection, vitamin D levels are also contributing to disease susceptibility. However, there may be other factors in the diet or in the environment that we have missed so far and that are important for causing MS. Next slide, please. This slide just shows you in different regions of the world, actually, that the numbers of patients affected by MS has increased throughout the world. And that has occurred over the past 100 years. It's been seen mostly through all over the world, except for a couple of regions where we're not sure why. In Tasmania and another region in Europe, actually doesn't look like there's been an increase, but everywhere else it has increased pretty substantially. And the increase actually has been mostly affecting women more than men. Next slide. So this increased worldwide because of its rapid mode of onset. It's probably not related to genes, but is much more likely related to changes in the environment. And I'm not sure why I don't see the next slide, so maybe you can go to the next slide. Yes, that's probably not sure why, but now I see it. So the reason why people have started to be very interested in what we refer to as the gut microbiome, which is basically the mix of different bugs that are in our gut, is that, in fact, the gut is the largest immune organ we have. And there's actually very dramatic changes throughout our life. But overall, this mix of bugs is stable over time, except when you're first born, because when you're first born, it's actually sterile, and you acquire most of your bugs in the gut around the first year of life. And it is now believed that the composition of the different bugs that are in the gut actually is critical for how your immune response will develop throughout the lifetime. And there are influences from the environment, such as the type of food you eat, whether you are exposed to antibiotics, whether you take specific medications that can alter the gut microbiome. And in other autoimmune disorders, such as atopy or asthma, and even some bowel autoimmune disorders, people have been studying the microbiome for many years in its relationship to the risk of the disease and the control of the disease. And although it may not be clear at this point, within the next few slides, you'll understand why it could be critical to improve prevention of MS, but also treatment of MS. So next slide, please. So we have a lot of bacteria in our gut. We have over 100 trillion bacteria, so there's a lot of, so many more bugs in our gut than the number of cells we have in the rest of the body. The normal bacteria are felt to help teach the immune system what is normal and what's not normal. So what's normal belongs and should be accepted, whether what is an invader should actually be fought. The bacteria that are in the gut can be altered in different ways. They can be altered in their density and the numbers, but also the kind of bacteria. There's different families that can vary up and down and create symptoms, and some have been found to be associated with the risk of asthma, for example. The changes in the bacteria of the gut are usually if you alter your diet or if you take antibiotics, the changes occur for a period of several weeks, then it goes back to your usual baseline. And what has been very interesting was to find that the type of bacteria you have in your gut is actually having a big impact on the immune system and also the regulation of the infections that one acquires throughout life. So the next slide, please. What we have looked at first are animal models, and the animal model for MS, one of the main ones is called EAE for experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis. And turning to the lab, the next slide will show you that people have can you go to the following slide? People have first started to uncover that in mice that were living in a sterile environment compared to mice that were living in a regular cage environment, the rate of EAE was actually different. And the mice that were living in a sterile environment actually were not developing the animal disease equivalent of MS, whereas the ones exposed to all sorts of germs actually were developing EAE. So the next group of work actually in animals have actually looked at the administration of the bacteria called Bacteroides, that is a very common bacteria, but seem to have the ability to reduce actually the severity of EAE in animals. And the curves that are presented here are just showing the rate of development of the disease and its severity, depending whether the animals receive the bacteria or not, and whether they are treated with antibiotics. So this work was really critical to try to advance our understanding of the relationship between bacteria in our guts, and also how they may regulate the severity of a disease in your brain. So the next slide. This has led actually other groups to study probiotics and EAE. So probiotics are a mix of different bacteria, and they are very fashionable right now. Lots of people take probiotics because there's all sorts of claims about how they may help different health situations. And in terms of MS, nothing has been studied really carefully in humans, and all the data we have is coming from the animal models. And some of the work has found that administering probiotics in animals was actually reducing the severity of EAE, and the researchers were able to detect changes in immune markers in the blood of these animals, showing that changing something in the environment of the gut actually could result in an effect that involves the entire immune response in the body. Next slide. Unfortunately, at this point, although there's been a few studies that I'm going to mention about how human gut bacteria may relate to MS, there's nothing that has been published. And I have to say that we have a manuscript that we've been trying to publish for a year and a half that goes from journal to journal and has not been published yet. And it's unclear why the community is not ready to accept this contribution possibly to MS. So I'm going to speak briefly about pilot data that was acquired with Dr. Ellen Maury, who is my trainee at UCSF and who is now at Hopkins, in a study in which we were testing whether vitamin D supplementation actually were bumping levels of vitamin D in the blood in MS patients, but also in controls similarly. And I'm going to talk about a pediatric study I've started to do with the Pediatric MS Network, and you heard about the Pediatric MS Network earlier also, and how we can leverage studying MS in very young patients. However, there's not only these two studies to be acknowledged, there's other studies ongoing at different sites in the U.S. and in the world to try to advance our understanding of how human gut bacteria may affect MS. Next slide, please. In the first study that we completed actually 2 years ago, we looked at patients who had relapsing remitting MS, that some of them were not treated, some of them were already on treatment with Copaxone or interferon, and we also enrolled healthy controls who all had insufficient levels of vitamin D. And we wanted to make sure that the supplementation of vitamin D in patients, but also in controls, was similar as we were designing a clinical trial of vitamin D supplementation. So next slide, please. This slide actually shows briefly how in our works we were able actually to get stool from patients and controls in a total of 15 individual provided stool, and most of them provided actually stool at the beginning of the study and at the end of the study. And this graphic here just shows you that the gut bacteria in MS patients actually differed whether they were on treatment or not. And in the top four patients, you can see that the composition of the gut bacteria is different from the green patients that were on treatment. So next slide. So first, that's an interesting finding because it questions whether the treatments such as interferon or Copaxone that we administer as injections through the skin may actually have an impact on the type of bacteria that people have in the gut. And maybe that way alter the immune response. So this slide here is just focused on the red and the green, and that's just showing in terms of patients in red and controls in green, what happened once people have taken the vitamin D for 3 months. And you can see that the changes, so the different bars are actually reflecting different bacteria that were modified by vitamin D treatment. And you can see that the differences were actually occurred differentially between patients and controls. So the next slide, please. And this is also looking at only in all the subjects that were in the study, what post and pre-composition of the bacteria were for these specific bacteria for which changes occurred. So you can see in red that before treatment with vitamin D, there were actually some of these bacteria were actually increased, whereas once treatment with vitamin D was given, the frequency and the abundance of these bugs were actually decreased. Next slide, please. Meanwhile, we started also at UCSF a pilot study in children who have MS and children who don't have MS. And the reason we were specifically interested in understanding the composition of bacteria in the gut in younger patients is that by the time you're 40 or 50, there may have been changes in your bacteria composition in the gut that may have nothing to do with MS, but is an accumulation of all the different changes in your diet and all the different antibiotic regimens you may have taken through your lifetime or different places in the world you may have been living. So by looking in children who are very close to disease onset, we felt that we were more likely to find changes that were actually related to disease onset as opposed to non-relevant exposures. So we were able in our pilot study to actually get stool from 13 pediatric MS patients and 6 controls. Next slide, please. And the first thing we started to look at were whether there were some bugs. So here the bugs are called OTUs on the big slide, whether specific bugs actually could differentiate between patients and controls. And with 18 different bugs, we were able to actually differentiate totally between patients and controls, as four of the bugs were detected in more than 65% of the controls, but never in the cases, and 14 were actually detected in most of the patients with MS, but not the controls. So the next slide. So this was exciting, but very preliminary, because remember, we are dealing with more than 100 trillion bugs in the gut, so we have to be careful with looking at such a small study. So this slide here is looking not only at presence or absence of some bugs in the gut flora, but also at the abundance. And these are the top 10 that actually came up as showing a difference in terms of abundance between cases and controls. That's also the way we can look at the data. Next slide, please. We can look with a single bug, what's the difference in abundance between patients in green and controls in blue. And so here you can see that for the specific bug that has just a long number to give its name, the patients actually had lower levels than controls. But on the next slide, you can see that there's also a difference in abundance within patients, between the ones who were treated for MS and the ones who were not treated yet. And here you can see the reverse, that basically treatment brought up the abundance for the specific bug were closer to normal levels, actually, compared to the untreated patient. Next slide. So I'll pass on that. So let's go to the next one. Next slide, please. And so I think that the next slide is actually recapitulating. Don't know who's okay. The next slide is recapitulating how, based on our preliminary data that I shared with you, how we were able to apply for a grant from the National MS Society to leverage the study of microbiome in children with MS. So the first thing I wanted to say is that this is a study in addition to a larger study that is ongoing in the United States that is funded by the NIH that is looking at risk factors for pediatric MS, whether they are in the environment or in the genes, and the interactions between the environment and the genes. And in that study, we're leveraging the fact that children who get MS may get MS because they've had a bigger exposure to relevant risk factors, or they may have more genetic risk factors. And for that study, we are having families complete a very comprehensive environmental questionnaire, looking at what type of antibiotics mom received during pregnancy, what type of medication the child has received early on in life, and also the type of diet. And because we have all this information, then we are able to leverage this information towards advancing our understanding of gut microbes and how they may contribute to MS. So in the our first aim is to look at the composition of the gut microbiome in 75 pediatric MS patients and 75 matched controls seen within the first year of onset of the disease. Then we're going to be able to evaluate whether, for example, birth by C-section or vaginal delivery or use of antibiotics and specific diet may contribute to actually the variations we see in the gut microbes, and whether that could be a way these different risk factors may contribute to MS onset. And then we have specific bugs we have identified that seem to be different with different medications for MS, such as interferon or Copaxone. And we want to try to confirm these because that would be fascinating if injecting interferon under your skin actually can result in changes in your immune system, but also in the type of bacteria we have in the gut. And then the last aim of this grant is to look for the association between the type of bacteria we have in the gut and whether they are associated with the relapse rate in the pediatric patients. And if we were able to detect actually a handful of microbes that are associated with subsequent relapse rates, then this would totally open the possibility to do a study of microbiotic in patients with MS to try to slow down progression of the disease. So the next slide, please. I'm almost done here. The early data that we have suggests that there's a relationship between MS and specific bacteria in the gut and possibly also with treatment. We're going in our study funded by the National MS Society that supports all the pediatric MS centers that are part of the study, that we're collecting samples, so the stool sample, but also oral and nasal samples to see whether changes in these places of the body also contribute to MS in one way or the other. So the next step, once we are able to come up with some of these bacteria, is treatment, whether use or discontinuation of use of specific antibiotics or a specific diet or macrobiotic or microbiome grafts actually could contribute to take care of MS better. So thank you for your attention, and we'll take questions at the very end.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing this really fascinating area of research with all of us. I'd now like to ask, I apologize, I've been having a little technical difficulty, if we have Dr. Liliana Amescua on the line?
I am here.
Oh, terrific. You're our final speaker, and let me just briefly reintroduce our last speaker, who is Assistant Professor of Neurology at the University of Southern California and co-director of the USC MS Comprehensive Care Center and Research Group. So now thank you again, and I look forward to hearing from you, Dr. Amescua.
Thank you so much for having me and for giving me this opportunity. I will be talking today about a minority population that has become more apparent with multiple sclerosis. And this is actually related to what we call a Hispanic or Latino. Specifically, Latinos are preferred, it's a preferred name in Los Angeles. But as you know, Hispanics really represent the largest minority ethnic group in the United States. And in fact, the number of Latinos with MS is thought to probably lead to an increased number of patients, particularly because of the proportions of Latinos in the population. And this is going to be certain pockets within the country, particularly the Southwest and also California and certain areas of the Eastern United States. How we know MS affects Latinos or Hispanics in the United States, it's really not understood, and primarily is because they are less studied. However, as we advance to the other slide, there is a lot of belief that they could really represent a population where we could start learning a lot more about MS. We certainly, there's beliefs that there is some health disparities, probably not just in the Hispanics, but other minority populations. One is, we do know that the overall rate of disease in Hispanics is less than in whites. However, the behavior of the disease, which I will be talking about, may be different. Of course, the knowledge of the disease with this population, it's probably not as well known as what we would expect within, what we know of, the whites. There is less outreach groups, educational programs that we need to start learning or coming together and creating them specific to their needs. Particularly, we do observe that they probably have, they use less of our support services, and we would definitely want to encourage that and understand those barriers. I do like to that I am immensely pleased and, you know, thankful to the National MS Society, because we recognize that this is one of their top priorities in diversity. And there was a dedicated article to Hispanics with MS in the last year, particularly in the Momentum magazine. So I think, you know, in respect to different aspects of what makes a Hispanic may lead us to clues about additional biological contributions to the disease. They represent a genetic admixed population. That means that we believe and we have, you know, epidemiological data that supports that a Hispanic is ancestrally linked to not just, you know, its European, its African, its Amerindian or Asian-derived genetic background. Environmentally, they represent a different population. We know that most of their origins come from lower latitude countries. They have different sun exposure behaviors and likely different infections and diets that, you know, could be protective or could be influencing the susceptibility of MS in them. So one of the things that we have recently seen is, and has been also reported in other studies, is that the age of onset, or at least as the first symptom of MS or diagnosis, appears to be at least 2 to 3 years younger than Hispanics. This was a study that we published in 2011, and a more recent study where it looks at incidence of MS. Also, you can clearly see from the second table that there are also much younger compared to your white and black background. In a NARCOMS reported, NARCOMS is a self-reported questionnaire-based registry where they just compared Caucasians or whites compared to Hispanics and African Americans, and you can also see that most of their symptoms appear in their 20s. Even though this is also seen in the African American and white, it always seems to be a little bit younger. And so this may clue us in into you know, different you know, environmental elements that may be important to the susceptibility of disease overall. Additional features that we are starting to recognize among Hispanics, and this is not, again, an everybody, but there seems to be some Asian features. And what I mean by Asian features is that when we think about MS in Asia, it appears to, one, is very rare, but when it does happen, they report a higher frequency of certain symptoms common overall to MS, but with higher frequency, and this tends to be optic neuritis or transverse myelitis, or what we know as inflammation of the eye or inflammation of the spinal cord. In the table in this slide, one can see that Hispanic whites designated as HW compared to non-Hispanic whites, there seems to be almost a 2 times risk of presenting more with optic neuritis or transverse myelitis. And so these are really important because, one, we do recognize that certain features at the onset of disease could indicate that these individuals may be at higher risk of disability short term, particularly spinal cord presentation. Additional features that we are observing in our individuals is, as I mentioned, our Latinos or Hispanics are really an admixed population. This beautiful figure at the top with multiple colors reflects individual columns of each individual affected. So these are 45 cases where we went ahead and took DNA and estimated their global ancestry. And so ancestral proportions, as depicted in green, represent European background, and the color in pink, along with a little bit of purple, are really reflective of what we call Amerindian or Asian background. And so as you can see, is that this population is very diverse, with individuals having as much as 90% genetic background of European, and the opposite spectrums also, where they have almost 90% to be reflective of Asian genes. What was interesting is that when we started looking, and again, these are just preliminary data, we are starting to note that the individuals that have higher non-European ancestral proportions seem to have a relationship with having more spinal cord presence or severity, and in turn, we're also associated with disability. Additional features that we are seeing as well of Hispanics with MS is that, of course, you know, this is a group that is, one, admixed. It's culturally rich, but it's also, there are differences in socioeconomic status, which is also probably related to different levels of migration. We were able to just take a look and see if there would be differences by migration, meaning the U.S. born compared to the ones that have been migrated here after age 15. We took age 15 because this was after puberty, and we looked to see just that age of diagnosis, and the U.S. born appears to be even significantly younger than the migrant. And what was interesting here is that the age of migration for the individual coming from their origin country was around 26 years of age, but the median lag time, meaning the time between the time that they migrated to the disease onset, was about 15 years. So this may be indicating that there is environmental elements that we need to analyze that are happening here once they move to the United States. What was also important to find was that these, of course, these groups, the more recent migrant, may be at risk of higher disability progression much faster. Of course, these are all just observations at this moment, but we don't know why we are seeing these differences. There's a lot of speculation that is sure there's likely socioeconomic differences, there's differences in the way that they understand MS. When one asks about MS in this population, they have hardly heard about the disease, and primarily it is likely that because it is a less prevalent condition that we are going to start finding important disparities. And so it is an important group to look at and to make outreach. Additional factors that we are finding, and just to remind everybody, we do believe that vitamin D is an important factor in the susceptibility of MS. And when we looked at our Hispanics compared to whites with MS, we did find significantly much lower levels of vitamin D in the Latino population. Now, this is not that surprising because actually when we look at the nutritional health analysis of the United States, it always tells us that Hispanics are at usually a risk of having low vitamin D. Well, if we do recognize that vitamin D is important to MS, well, these individuals have lower levels. Our understanding of how MS affects the Hispanic is really limited. Again, most of the studies, the observations that I have just presented are really just observations that we are starting to note. There's a lot to do. We need to do larger studies, have proper comparisons, but questions that start arising that could help us frame our future studies is, one, why are they younger when they present? Are there specific clinical features that could serve as prognostic indicators for us to identify the ones at a high risk of disability? Could they be at high risk of disability long term? And if they are, what are those barriers? What is leading them to disability? Is it genetic background that could help us sort by looking at them? It might be able to provide clues not just for MS and Hispanics, but MS in overall population. Are they getting the same care that is available to others? Are there cultural, social factors impeding their treatment and care? We really need to reach out and be able to, you know, create focus groups for them. So one of the things, and leaving you last with the last two slides, is that here in the LA, we are in the process of developing the Wellness Center, and this really is it's basically came out of the LA County officials to try to restore health among, you know, the LA County population. And so what it did was brought nonprofit organizations to coordinate health and wellness, to share the knowledge and best practices. And we were able to put in a proposal 2 years ago together with the National Society and USC's MS Care to have a place for MS. And we are very excited because I think this is going to be developing quite soon. You know, the Wellness Center is really, we see it as a potential economic, social, and environmental solution, but it's also a place of learning. While it houses multiple nonprofit tenant organizations, it will facilitate the sharing of services that might otherwise be prohibitively expensive. And so one is the conferencing, the meeting space, the bringing together educational programs, learning about the community from any ethnic or background, foster opportunities for collaboration, including promoter training. And promoter, I refer to as social workers that go out in the community and engage with certain populations. They primarily have been successful in minority, such as Latino populations, where they integrate and be able to follow and educate about the conditions. Particularly, we see it as an important element here in the Latino population because, again, this is a less prevalent condition among them and a less heard disease. So we hope to serve a diverse population. And with that, I'd like to say thank you and look forward to questions.
I gotta go because we're going to do questions.
Okay. Terrific. Thank you so much for your work to better understand and to care for this underserved MS community. I'd like to thank all three of our speakers and now to ask our operator to open up the call for questions to any of them.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions at this time, please press the number one key. Our first question will come from Lisa. Lisa, please go ahead.
Two short questions. The lady that spoke about the gut bacteria, does she recommend that people with MS take probiotics?
So can I directly answer the question, or do you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So this is a very good question, and I do not recommend that people take probiotics. There's, you know, most probiotics have actually 3 or 4 or 5 bacteria in them. And as you heard me, there's 100 trillion bacteria in your gut. So whether how you pick the probiotic that you would want to take for a condition like MS really should be decided based on results of studies like the one I was outlining, because otherwise, you know, you could look at the whole shelf of microbiotics and not know which ones could worsen the disease or could improve the disease. Because in the animal models, actually, depending on the bacteria, depending on the cocktail of antibiotics, you could make the disease worse or you could improve it. Now, whether the same situation exists in humans isn't clear, and we have to try to clarify that, but there's certainly a possibility for making things potentially worse based on what we've seen in animal models, so we have to be careful.
Okay. Also, along with that, you mentioned antibiotics. If you took a lot of antibiotics when you were younger, would that have promoted getting MS?
Not that we know of. This is something we're going to, we are currently studying with the national study we're doing in pediatric MS that I mentioned. So if you're asking me the question again in 2 years, I should be able to answer whether there is actually a difference
because it has never been looked at.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Rosemary. Rosemary, please go ahead.
Thank you. This is for Dr. Seikold.
Yes.
I'd like to know if you've heard of any anecdotal reports or research indicating which antidepressants are best for treating MS-caused neurological depression.
Thank you for a great question. That's one of the things we really are interested in looking at, and the answer is that we don't know. One of the things that seems to be, well, what we're exploring and what we looked at in a very exploratory manner with our data was the role of antidepressants, and there is some evidence that if the antidepressants are working, so that if the depressive symptoms have been decreased, that you do see that those changes that we talked about that are present in the depressed patients are not there. And even in people who are on antidepressants, if they're still having depressive symptoms, they look like somebody who, you know, has depressive symptoms. So the key factor is probably, I don't know this for sure, but it seems from this initial data, it probably doesn't matter which antidepressant. It matters if it's working and if it's effective in decreasing the depressive symptoms. And one of the things we definitely found in our second study was there are lots of folks who have MS depression who are on antidepressants, but they're still having a lot of depressive symptoms. So we think that there's a lot of depression that is undertreated, and what it appears that it's necessary to really be successful in getting rid of the depression, and whether there's a particular antidepressant that's better at that than others is not known. I know for most of us who see MS patients, we tend to use, you know, the standard kind of what they call SSRIs, like Prozac or Paxil, and sometimes ones that have more activating effects like Prozac can be helpful, but a lot of folks are on other kinds of combinations as well. But I think the key is probably that we're successful in getting rid of the depression. But it's a great question and one that I hope that we'll be able to address in our future studies.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Dina. Dina, please go ahead.
Hi. Listen, my paternal mother was Hispanic. Should I consider myself an Hispanic?
Is that the question?
Yeah, and it goes to Dr.
Yes.
Mesquite.
Yeah, so do you know, right, so Hispanic is such a broad umbrella, right? Hispanic, you know, we refer as individuals from Latin America, but it's also a connection of, you know, they share the same cultural beliefs and share the same language, but it can be all through Latin America. It could be, you know, originally from Spain, but we are looking right from Latin America. So if your mother is Hispanic, then you are half Hispanic.
My paternal grandmother.
You're a paternal, right, so paternal, so some sort, right, so some percentage of you as claimed Hispanic. And so initially when we started doing these studies, of course, you know, that was the whole thing. What do you consider a Hispanic? And so one of the things that we, you know, was self-identification, and then inquiring about background up to two generations. So that would be grandparents, right? And so if the grandparents had some sort of Hispanic background, you know, they meet the criteria as of now. But, you know, in the end, I see this going forward. If genetic genotyping and looking at genetic ancestry becomes part of the normal, then it won't matter what one claims, right? It's more about trying to identify, could by leveraging on this recent admixture, particularly within the Latinos, because we're talking about admixture that occurred over the last 500 years, that we could try to identify genetic contributions perhaps to certain features of MS that are, particularly within the regions that are marking ancestral components. That's one way. But it also offers an opportunity to disentangle also genetic contributions from behavioral, from cultural. And so this is the way that I see it. But yes, so, what is Hispanic? And so what is Hispanic is really important in the way, not just the susceptibility of MS, but also in the way that we'll be treating and reaching out. So that's my two cents of what a Hispanic is. But yeah, I would consider a bit of you, right, Hispanic.
And how would you contribute then to the genome research you're doing?
Yes, so basically what we're doing is we are taking genome-wide data from the Latinos, and you take certain what we call ancestral informative markers, or certain markers. At this point, we're using about 2,100 that have been used to classify what a Hispanic background should be, or what it correlates with what we call global ancestry. And so we're able to separate them at the basis of global, meaning European, Asian, and African. But we are also able to do even further. We can start looking at local. And so the contributions that we see going forward is one, not just about characterizing the disease a lot better, but also by identifying individuals that could be at risk of a certain types of symptoms. But eventually, it could be important also in the way that we treat MS and telling us, is this particular treatment as effective in this population as it is in others, as we have learned from many other conditions where certain treatments are not.
Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time this evening. I'd like to thank those of you for your really terrific questions, and I'd like to thank all of our speakers for joining us tonight and all of you for calling in to hear more about some of the exciting research that's being done to stop, restore, and end MS. Thank you. And this ends our call.